This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Like the kōkako, the saddleback, or te eke, belongs to the New Zealand wattlebird family. A family to which the huia belonged and which has been established in this country since ancient times, much longer than most of our other birds. The saddleback takes its name from the bright reddish saddle on its back, which according to legend is the mark of Maui's hand. Sadly, this attractive bird has disappeared from the main islands and exists only on a few offshore islands, carefully chosen locations for resettlement away from predators, which appears to have saved the te eke from total extinction.
Community or chaos, we can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.org.nz.
Good morning, friends. Today we have with us Kay Harrison, the former climate ambassador, climate change ambassador for New Zealand. And you can podcast this by going to oarfm.org.nz, then going to podcasts and then going to Community or Chaos. Well, welcome to Community or Chaos, Kay.
Good morning and thank you for having me.
When and why did you first become seriously concerned about climate change or global warming? And is this was your term up when you retired from being New Zealand ambassador for climate change?
Well, I didn't know a lot about climate change for most of my career. I joined the Ministry for the Environment in 2009 to work on the emissions trading scheme, and I really didn't know anything about it. But from the moment I got there and started to learn about the situation with climate change, it became just the most compelling thing for me to work on. And I have worked on it ever since. It seems to me the only thing I wanted to do. I didn't have a specific term as climate change ambassador. I resigned from that role. Lots of reasons, but I'll be honest, it was going to be increasingly difficult, I thought, to represent New Zealand with the government policies that were being put forward by the coalition. And so even though it's not all bad, I will say, I didn't feel that I'd be able to do that job in the way it needed to be done, you know, as an enthusiast for government policy.
Okay. What is the global situation nearly 10 years after the Paris Agreement was set up?
Well, globally, we still have the Paris Agreement, which is really good. It's alive, well, and operating as it's planned, and that's absolutely crucial. But the really bad news is the state of the climate. And I guess one of the difficult things is that there's a large time lag, perhaps 20 to 40 years, between the time we human beings put our greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere and then the manifestation of those effects. And so, you know, you will have seen on the news only yesterday the flooding in Texas. We've also had our own flooding and damage in New Zealand in this last week. That sort of thing is only going to get a great deal worse. Because really, we are feeling the effects, if you like, of a lot earlier emissions than, you know, the last several decades of unprecedented pollution into the atmosphere. And of course, New Zealand is responsible for 18 billion tons, which is an enormous amount of CO2 in the atmosphere still now, as a result of the the cutting down of all of, you know, two-thirds of the forest in our country over the last century and a half.
In New Zealand, to some extent, and certainly in Europe, climate change catastrophes like heat waves and other things are the press there attributes them to climate change. But as I understand it, in America, the press no longer is likely to attribute climate catastrophes to climate change.
Yeah, that is a huge worry, because one of the most important things that we can do is talk about climate change all the time, not in a frightened or defeatist way, but in a way that reminds us constantly that we are in a crisis. I mean, imagine going through the COVID crisis and not talking about COVID. You know, I mean, that would be crazy, right?
So, why aren't New Zealanders more concerned about climate change compared to other crises or threats to New Zealand, for instance, the economy and foreign affairs?
Well, they're not alone in that. But New Zealanders have shifted their views. In 2023, 80% of New Zealanders were concerned about the impact of climate change on their country. But the latest figure is 69%. 54% of us think we should do more, and that's down from 64% only in 2024. So in the scheme of things, as you were alluding to, New Zealanders are less concerned about climate change than inflation or healthcare or the economy. Now, well, the answer doesn't just apply to New Zealanders. The fact of the matter is human beings are much more interested in the immediate problem in front of them, the urgent thing. And to be fair, if you're a family that is worried about whether or not you have a place to live or you can feed your family, rightly so, those things are going to be paramount in your mind. Not actually easy. It requires us all to change. And so we're tempted instead to find either something else that's more important or someone to blame. So in terms of does our government follow the views of New Zealand people, or does the government shape the views of New Zealand people? I tend to think that they reflect them very much. And you will have seen under this national-led coalition government, a number of climate change policies have been reversed, like, for example, the permitting of offshore oil and gas exploration. You know, that's a major shift. But nevertheless, they are still part of the Paris Agreement. They still have a current target, and they have all of the really important architecture. We have, as New Zealanders, have all the important architecture to transition our economy. The volume is turned right down.
It seems to me that a lot of the things we, the government particularly, needs to do about climate change adaption and mitigation are actually things we need to do for infrastructure, like having rail ferries that work properly, like emphasizing public transportation, including trains, and other things we can do for building alternative energy. All these things are actually positive.
Absolutely.
For New Zealand.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I mean, we need energy and we need transportation, and we need to make the decisions about them in light of the context of the climate crisis in which we are living.
Doesn't that call for more collective action?
So make good
action.
Choices about fuel type, etc.
I mean, if you have good public transportation.
To be honest, this is the biggest collective action, collaboration, cooperation challenge that humanity has faced. It's something where it's not okay. I mean, it's not going to work if one part of the world or deals with their transition problem and decarbonizes. If the rest of the world isn't decarbonized, then you still have the problem. It's a collective problem, and therefore collective action is critical. But if you mean collective action in terms of advocacy and pressure, that is also a part of it. I mean, there are multiple roles in this crisis that people need to step up and play.
I often think that the reason I ride an electric bike isn't so much that it's going to have a huge effect, but it provides an incentive and a way for me to talk about climate change without feeling too hypocritical.
Yeah.
I mean, somehow we have to convince that we need to lead society, not fall behind society. I mean, sometimes you have to take chances if you're going to be responsible for your country.
Yeah, I mean, I would like to think that our elected leaders provide leadership and provide governance and are not just responsive to the trends in society that may not necessarily be in our best interests. One of the things that's been really obvious to me as a person who's worked in policy and government is governments are elected and they have these, you know, great ideas, and then a lot of the time we would have to disabuse them of their simple notion about how something could be solved or fixed and say, yeah, I understand that idea was important to you in the election, and here are the other consequences of this that you didn't recognize. And, you know, I understand that when you were elected, it was on a platform that criticized the Paris Agreement, and here are the risks and the consequences of distancing yourself from that. And, you know, so... But at the same time, we get the government, I think, that we deserve, right? We get the government we elected. And if they go off a script that we can follow or support, then they won't be there the next time.
I guess one of the problems with governance is climate change is not only something we need to work on now, but it's also long term. It won't be fixed in 3 years.
That's absolutely right. And that has been a challenge for probably every government in the world for a long time. And what you saw happen in New Zealand in the last 10 years was the construction of this kind of architecture, this infrastructure around climate change in the law that allows us to look, not have knee-jerk reactions from one three-year electoral cycle to another, but allows us to have a system of a climate change commission that provides expert and independent advice, a law that requires the government to set an emissions budget and to have a plan, and for that plan to be scrutinized. And that is all in place, and that is really, really sound. And that was passed across the House. So with the only non, you know, the only vote against it would have potentially have been from David Seymour, but he was not present in the House when that vote took place. So we had this very good cross-party understanding of exactly what you said, the long-term nature of the problem and how critical it is that we
have. Are you pleased in a way that, or not pleased, but surprised, and maybe a little pleased that the architecture that we've passed is still in place
to deal with it, and not. Yes, it is still in place, and it is really good. Of course, it's not going perhaps It's just a, you know, at a very kind of slow pace. And there are some quite contradictory things, I think, in terms of you know, the work that is being proposed on exploration of fossil fuels, etc.
They say that even the people that are exploring for fossil fuels say it'll be, you know, it'll be a generation before you could use it. By that time, climate change is going to be a lot worse.
Absolutely. And I think, well, I mean, there are two things about putting your, you know, investing in fossil fuels is, one, it's pretty, I would have thought it was pretty risky because you're not going to be in a settled regulatory environment. You're going to know that if you want to come and invest in that in New Zealand, then there's a chance that a government, you know, quite quickly down the road is going to make life difficult for you. So that's one thing. But also in terms of energy security, New Zealand's absolutely best bet is to bring more and more renewables on stream as fast as possible. And those renewables give us energy, not only energy security, but we're not going to be facing the volatility of the international market, as well as crippling ourselves with higher emissions. So the best course of action for us is ramp up at pace our construction of renewable energy generation.
When we're looking at energy generation, when we choose models for that, should we choose models with climate change mitigation in mind?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it's in my view, knowing what we know, it is irresponsible to propose or invest in or go down a path of fossil fuels. Now, it's not always 100% like that. I know, for example, of a case of a Pacific island whose pathway to 100% renewable generation does require upgrading some of their diesel generation at this point. But the long-term pathway and the objective has to be decarbonisation. And suggesting in any way that it is responsible to burn fossil fuels is defies the science and defies what's in the best interests of humanity. So yes, we need to keep the lights on. Yes,
we have a lot more choices than some Pacific Islanders, don't we? Because we not only have wind power and solar panels, but we also have hydro lakes and so on. So we don't have the excuse that a country that has none of those things has.
That's right. I remember hearing from the offshore wind sector, they believe they could produce 600% of New Zealand's electricity needs through offshore wind farming. And so it's not necessarily easy, but we know that we can produce so much more. Not only that, I've been in a situation where I've heard other countries express interest in purchasing energy from New Zealand, whether it's you know, recognizing just the incredible potential we have of an export market there.
What's happening internationally in the United Nations and in Europe?
Well, in terms of the climate change part of the United Nations, it is, as I was saying at the start, it's still operational, it's alive and well. You and your listeners will know that every year the conference of the parties meets, and tens of thousands of people attend that meeting because it is a kind of like a lightning rod where we stop and we look at the global situation in response to climate change. So that is good. That is good. What we need to be doing is transitioning to a place where this is about implementation and sharing and enabling, as opposed to continuing to negotiate. We have all the rules for the system that we need. We have our self-assigned responsibilities in terms of our targets. Now we need to be thinking about implementation and supporting one another. It's a great place to for non-government organizations to come in as well, and to critique the pace of effort by countries, but also to comment on things like the degree to which developed countries like ours are providing sufficient support for developing countries. One of the interesting groups that I've encountered at in these negotiations are the United Nations Quaker organization, and they bring a quite a unique perspective and play a role in supporting the human beings that are the negotiators from different countries to connect with one another in a human way and understand one another. And I think that's particularly special way in which non-government players have a role in this effort.
Do we have a special obligation to the Pacific Island neighbors? We talk about them politically and in foreign policy a lot. In some ways, they're most at risk. Some of those islands may actually disappear, and others will be very difficult. So, what are our obligations to the Pacific Islands as far as climate mitigation and also helping them?
Yes, you're absolutely right. Pacific Island countries are facing really inexorable and exacerbating impacts of climate change. Not only, we hear about sea level rise a lot, but one of the problems with sea level rise or sea level encroachment is that it can, salt water will wreck crops. It will contaminate freshwater sources, and that leads to health impacts. But I guess the thing is that we do have a system through the Paris Agreement and the Climate Change Convention that says that countries who are able to need to provide support. And New Zealand is in that category of you are able to provide support to these countries who are the least responsible for this problem. And so you need to do so. And at the COP last year, at the big conference of the parties, we agreed that developed countries would mobilize $300 billion in climate finance and aid, essentially, for developing countries by 2035. New Zealand's last climate finance commitment was a good one for the years 2022 to 2025, and we provided $1.3 billion. And that didn't come necess that didn't come, just from the government coffers. It came in particular from the ETS, the Emissions Trading System, where emitters like the big greenhouse gas emitters in New Zealand were paying for their emissions, and that money was then in part recycled into the Pacific. Unfortunately, this year in this year's budget, the government has announced a much greater reduction of down to something like $100 million per annum. We are hoping that maybe they'll find some more than that, but that's a considerable cut, and that's absolutely the wrong direction of travel.
Well, I think we'll play some music now and then we'll get back to climate change. Well, that was Simon Kerr and Sweet Lover, and the song was For Those Who Are to Come. And we're talking with Kay Harrison, former New Zealand Ambassador for Climate Change. And you can podcast this by going to orfm.org.nz and then going to podcast and going to Community or Chaos. Kay, what would you say to people who say there's no point in trying to continue mitigating because we're already past it, everything's set, and we're getting feedback, so no point in trying to mitigate. All we have to do is just plan on accepting the worst and building for the worst. But sort of the people that want to give up on climate mitigation.
Yeah, I can understand how some people would feel that way. It seems very daunting, but the fact of the matter is, if you think about what we've tried to limit warming to an average global warming increase of 1.5 or 2 degrees, and by the way, that never sounds like very much, but in fact, you might know that the oceans around New Zealand were sort of 6 degrees higher than they should be recently. And in some places, it'll be a lot more than that. And so we're not talking about really just a very fine balance here. But that scientific number of 1.5 or 2 is what we've aimed to limit warming to. But even 2 degrees is better than 2.5 degrees. And 2.5 is better than 2.7. Every point makes a huge difference. They are all terrible numbers in real terms, but we're dooming ourselves if we think we can throw up our hands, continue to pollute and let this get worse and worse. Of course, the worse you let it get, the more expensive it becomes, both to recover from disasters, but to adapt. And of course, there is this very, there is this very attractive alternative world, which is safer and cleaner. And it's there for us. We've got the technology. We need to mobilize it.
What do you think about people? What do you think about geoengineering? Do you talk about that with people, or do they?
I've
always had mixed feelings, because what I know about geoengineering is some forms of geoengineering you have to continue to keep in place, and if you can't keep it in place, climate change might suddenly get very much worse.
I think we are in a really dire situation, and as I said earlier, much worse is already baked in for us. We've already kind of committed to much more severe weather. I personally think we should be open to exploring whatever we can to manage this. And I know some scientists who work in solar radiation modification, as they call it, ways in which you might humanly intervene in the atmosphere to manage the greenhouse gas effect that we have. I think sometimes people think, oh my gosh, that's sort of interfering with nature. Well, that boat has sailed. We have completely interfered with nature to the point where some people are using the term Anthropocene, the first period in the Earth's history when it's human beings that are determining the climate system. So I personally think we should explore it. But like anything that may have unintended consequences or affects the collective, there needs to be some degree of global governance around it. And we know that there are already universities that are experimenting with these techniques, sending things up into the atmosphere. New Zealand, along with Switzerland, attempted to bring up the question of should there be some degree of global governance and management around people doing things in the atmosphere, but that has not been successful to date. At the same time, this is not a case of if we can use these tricks in the atmosphere to manage the problem, we can keep on emitting. No, we still absolutely have to do this transition to a decarbonized world. We can't continue to pump this pollution into the atmosphere. But we are also at the point where things are going to get very, very bleak. And so if there are some solutions or some things that can help us, I think we should explore them.
Aren't they more like Band-Aids than solutions? I'm not saying that you can only have them for a very short period of time, but aren't they something we do in the hopes that we can actually decarbonize so we won't, at some point we won't need them?
Yeah, they could be. They could be, or they could be more long-term solutions. I think it's all part of the mix, and it will depend on which technique you're referring to there. But it's, yeah, I think it's all hands to the pump.
What's the place of banks and economic and financial institutions in climate change?
They're absolutely critical to this. This is one of the reasons why I really struggle with people who describe climate change as an environmental issue. The fact of the matter is climate change is a system-wide issue, and we need all of the parts of the global economy to be leaning in on this action. One of the crazy things about banks and the way economies work is that, in fact, doing the right thing can sometimes cost you in a way that it shouldn't. So I want to give you the example of the country of Colombia. Colombia has lots of oil reserves. It elected a government that said, we understand what's happening in the climate. It is irresponsible to be contributing to that further. Therefore, we will reconfigure our economy so that it is no longer dependent on oil reserves. Now, that means that when the government of Colombia wants to borrow money, as governments do, it now faces an unsurmountable kind of interest rate for borrowing money because it is no longer using its oil reserves as its kind of the assets that back it. Now, that's just not in anybody's interests. We need the economies of Colombia and others to be successful without resorting to digging up fossil fuels. This is a subject for the banks globally. There are organizations of finance ministers around the issue of climate change, but they do absolutely need to turn their attention to making the money available for the right things and disincentivizing money for the wrong things.
Speaking of banks, have you read Ken Stanley Robinson's Ministry for the Future, and what did you think of the book?
It's a fantastic read. It's a fantastic read. I think Kim Stanley Robinson's brand of science fiction is the near future. And, some people might remember, I believe this to be true, that the idea for smartphones and tablets actually came from episodes of Star Trek, where people had their transponder and all the rest of it in their hand. Well, Kim Stanley Robinson has some great near future science fiction ideas that are quite radical around banks, but also about transportation. I found it quite a hopeful read, and I'd definitely recommend it to others. if you can get over the first chapter, which is absolutely horrific, which is, you know, which is about a climate disaster. But yeah, good read.
Speaking of somewhat good news, and some of the local bodies, including Dunedin City Council, have made positive decisions about energy use and decarbonizing the city works. Can you talk about what local bodies can do?
Yeah, I think it's great. And a number of our local bodies in New Zealand have got their own climate plans, as in fact do a number of iwi. And there I would absolutely commend to you the climate strategy of Ngaitahu. The fact of the matter is there are huge savings to be had in decarbonisation. And so where you have the ability to take those shifts, you will be reaping the benefits, and so will your community. So, you know, what you can do is you can look at your strategy, you can look at your long-term plan, you can think about the infrastructure that you need to replace, and it's decision points like that where you can make the calls to take you further on that decarbonisation pathway. That's true for individuals and households as well. But, you know, individuals and households are helped by the regulations. So if, for example, it is no longer permitted for you to install gas heating, then that's, you know, that negative option has been taken out of your hands. But I think we're seeing decarbonisation in ports and airports where small vehicles, light vehicles are now electric. That's really the big place to go to, is the light vehicle fleet. And hopefully we're going to see the trickle-on effect of the support the previous government gave for EVs and building a much bigger secondhand market for ordinary folks to get into that space. Because believe me, there is absolute joy in driving a vehicle that you never take into a petrol station except for when you need to buy a pie.
That's a good thing for those who can afford it. Probably most New Zealanders can't really afford to buy electric cars.
No, but they will be able to afford to buy the second-hand cars, electric cars, that come through the system. I mean, most of us do, you know, we're reliant on that kind of that system. In fact, most of the new cars coming into New Zealand in the past have been fleet vehicles. And we had this enormous surge in the purchase of EVs over the last few years, which has gone down, unfortunately. But that should start to make its way through to the secondhand market and to us. But also there are new options like mobility as a service. So using providers like that provide electric vehicles for a subscription or for a fee, because in fact we don't use our cars much of the time, most of the time. Of course, in New Zealand we've got our own particular challenges because we're a long and skinny country, and it's not necessarily straightforward to have good quality mass transit as we do in major cities around the world. But this situation is getting better, and I think people need to look very hard at that question of, is this unaffordable for me, or, you know, will it be unaffordable for me, and just look into that market.
Well, one thing I've noticed is that my son lives in Wellington and my grandchildren live in Wellington, and they don't use their cars very much at all. And I know also I'm aware a lot of younger people don't even have cars in Wellington because they probably have the best bus system or public transport system in New Zealand. So is that a major part of the answer, to have much better, more convenient public transport?
It is. It's not. It can be costly depending on the size of your ratepayer base, but yeah, in Wellington we are actually very fortunate. We grizzle, of course. We complain sometimes, but we are very fortunate. I was visiting a country. I was visiting Luxembourg recently, and there they have very, very beautiful trams and electric buses, and their entire transport system is free. So these things are possible and they're also desirable, but they are expensive for the communities that have to set them up.
The green,
Nevertheless,
if we had a
we
more
are.
green economy and the government was willing to raise taxes like capital gains and other kinds of taxes, we could actually do what European countries are doing more so than we are now anyway.
Well, even if we had managed to set the emissions trading system settings in a way that generated from the polluters the finance that we had during the last government, we would have a lot of money that could be then ploughed into electric bus services. They did that in California. The Californians have an emissions trading system, and they use the finance from that for particularly for impoverished communities, poorer communities, but also for things like electric school buses. And they have emblazoned on these buses, this bus has come to you courtesy of the California cap and trade scheme. So where the money of polluters is being put back into even more decarbonisation action and in communities that need it most.
So there's probably a lot of things we could do if we were willing to take a few financial risks and explore different ways of going places. I mean, not just physically, but sometimes I think our vision is too narrow.
Well, talking of risk, I think the risk of not doing these things is far, far greater and far more expensive, and is a certainty, not a possibility. We know that we have this climate crisis. We know that we have built into our future some hideous disasters ahead. We also know that by spending more money now, we can reduce the costs ahead of us. We know that. And so this isn't about let's take a punt, let's take a risk. This is a dead certainty, and that's where we should be directing our finances.
Well, we know what's going to happen if we don't mitigate climate change, pretty much. This actually brings up a question. 20 years or so ago, I was part of a group associated with the University of Otago concerned with sustainability and climate change. And one of the big arguments we had was how open and honest should we be about how serious and devastating climate change would become if we didn't mitigate it. And we were warned not to frighten the horses. Was that a mistake? Could you talk about it? Also, I think scientists are naturally conservative because in their training and so on, they need to have evidence and provide evidence and count and have other people check that evidence. And that's good science, but it may not be climate change mitigation.
Well, to your first question, was it a mistake? Well, I think we have to take seriously the anxiety that the knowledge we have about climate change and what is ahead of us, as well as what we're experiencing now, the anxiety that that can cause. At the same time, more now than 20 years ago, we must balance that with the positive knowledge the truth that, in fact, we know how to deal with this. We know what we can do. And therefore, this is, you know, I've heard people say, for example, well, you know, don't get into this climate change work because we're going to have it solved in 20 years. So it's not a long-term career. I don't know if I agree with that, but we do have the solutions in our hands if we want to take them. At the same time, you know, you don't avoid telling your teenage child not to take up smoking because a death from cancer is horrific. We're very clear that we need to make that point. But I guess the thing is, everyone will create a kind of a narrative in their head for climate change, and whether that narrative is a balance of the reality and the threat that it is, the danger that it is, plus the knowledge, the positive knowledge of the solutions that we have, you know, or for others, it will be, as we said earlier, no, there are more urgent things. I'm not going to be the one to worry about that. Or it'll be Trump's fault or Big Oil's fault or somebody else's fault, but not mine, and therefore I don't need to take action. But I think we've got to the point where, in fact, the science is well and truly known. In our case, we have systems through global governance of the Paris Agreement and the architecture in our own legislation. Actually, it's a time when everyone needs to step up and find out what their role is and their own decisions in taking action.
Aren't we all citizens of a democracy, or most all the people listening to this program? So doesn't that give us a real obligation to influence our society, both individually, but also to influence government?
And yes, absolutely. We're not only we are all voters. We do have a responsibility. We need to be clear with potential new governments what it is we expect them to do and the leadership we expect them to provide. But we also have an obligation to share that knowledge with one another, and I think one of the key things is to talk about this issue of climate change all the time. Everything else we are dealing with in society is happening in the context of our very present crisis that is still with us. This is not something that is, you know, comes and goes. It is with us. It's like being in a permanent COVID situation.
Okay, you've got about 3 more minutes before we program ends. Would you like to say anything about how you see the intermediate and long-term future, or anything else you think of is really important to remind us of?
Thank you. Yeah, I think in addition to all of the other things that we've talked about this morning, I guess I'd like people to think about the personal moral challenge that is confronting them. We are all of us responsible for climate change. We are all of us responsible for emissions, and we should resist feeling powerless or bewildered, because that could lead us to being, you know, defensive or silent. When in fact, you know, as you were just saying, we have choices. We have, some would say, obligations within a democratic society to seek the leadership that we need for these important issues. But I think just thinking about what it is that's going on in our head, are we trying to find someone to blame? Are we thinking that it's hopeless? And in fact, what's the result of having that narrative in your head? Instead, I think we should be looking for ways to enhance cooperation and think about what we do well when we can work collectively and seek that together. and overcome those kind of barriers to the solution that we need. So on the one hand, I feel hopeful. But on the other hand, I can see that this is an enormous challenge. But then think about history. Think about Rosa Parks in the southern states of the US in the 1950s. Could she imagine a world without segregation and discrimination? And could she understand that her act of taking a seat on a bus where only whites were allowed to sit might make such a huge difference? And then I think we turn to ourselves and say, that small act that we think might be pointless might in fact be a Rosa Parks moment.
We've been talking with Kay Harrison, former New Zealand Ambassador for Climate Change. Thank you, Kay. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.